ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Late Night Live Summer. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Until the day of her death, at the age of 101, Leni Riefenstahl insisted she was an artist. Idealistic, of course, but simply an artist, when she made two of the greatest propaganda films of all time, Triumph of the Will in 1935 and Olympia in 1938, both glorifying Hitler and the Nazis. As films, they are magnificent, though perhaps Quentin Tarantino went a bit far when he called Riefenstahl the best director that ever lived. And she lived a long, long time, denying her Nazi enthusiasms all the way. But she left behind a huge archive, which the director Andreas Feil has mined for his documentary simply titled Riefenstahl. And Andreas is with me in the studio. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Yeah, hello.
Do you doubt that Leni Riefenstahl was a great filmmaker?
Well, of course she was a great filmmaker, but you can't separate her aesthetics from politics. And as you mentioned, she always pretended, I am just an artist and I never was interested in politics. So she wanted to separate it. But of course, when you look closer, she was from the very, very beginning, 1933, she was an enthusiastic National Socialist. Actually, she told about this commitment in interviews in the early 30s. So to say, well, she was just a great artist, it's a bit naive. She was a great writer. She was a great director. She was, also an editor, an interesting editor, but she was producing propaganda for a regime which was responsible for 60 million deaths in the very end.
I'm not saying only, but I'm saying also. She was also a great filmmaker.
Yeah, that's...
And let's just look at what she did for a moment. You make the point that she, in a way, invented the aesthetic of propaganda films.
Yeah, I won't say she invented it, because when you look at Russian filmmakers like Eisenstein, they also staged the monumental force of an ideology. But she could use the formation of bodies who were just reduced like robots, the choreography of the masses. And that's different even when compared to films of Eisenstein from the Russian avant-garde. So in a way, she was addicted to the ideology of the Third Reich. And she was ingenious in finding images which would transfer the ideas of the ideology of strength, of beauty, of supremacy into cinematographic images, into a cinematographic language.
You've no doubt that she was a great filmmaker. She was many other things as well. She was also, in its way, a magnificent liar.
Yeah, she was. She was, I think, regarding legends regarding fabricating fake news on her biography. She was perfect, especially after the war, when she was confronted with, the consequences of her propaganda films, that she made propaganda for a regime with all these atrocities regarding the Holocaust. She always said, no, I had nothing to do with it. I learned about the Holocaust after the war, and we will talk about it. Of course she knew. When we're talking about the master of legends and lies, the interesting point is how persistent she was. She was stuck in the ideology after the war, creating or being petrified in these lies and legends. She continued, even everybody knew it's a lie. She was just stuck in it, and she continued.
She just lied blind. She just lied, and she kept lying.
Yeah.
And no evidence that was ever presented to her made her shift.
Yeah, and she had special tools to transfer these lies. Why? She was an actress before, and she used these tools to present the lies. And one is being aggressive. So if Riefenstahl is here, we're here, and you would ask a critical question, she would shout at you and intimidate you, and you would stop asking these questions. Or charming, please have another cup of coffee, and before you start asking me critical questions, you need a second coffee. Yeah.
Yes, you are my guest.
Yeah, yeah. And the third one, look, my life was so harsh, and I'm pursued by the Jews, by everyone after the war, like a witch. I'm treated like a witch, and you dare asking critical questions. I suffered so much, and how dare you continuing my suffering? So she had different means and methods, and they were very, very successful. That's the interesting point. It's not just the lies. It's the tools of the lies, how she persisted and impressed people.
And it worked.
Yeah, it worked, and people even... They changed their attitude towards her. It was like brainwashing. I had several interviews with people in the beginning. They said, yes, I was from... Whenever I heard the name Riefenstahl, I could just vomit. And then they met Riefenstahl. And then, yes, I have to somehow reset my opinion. She's a very interesting, strong woman. And when we think about how she achieved her goals in a male-dominated world of party members.
Oh, what a heroine. What a heroine in the face of everything.
Yeah.
But it's just so astonishing that lies can work in that way. Just astonishing. The other astonishing thing is that she left behind a meticulously curated... vast amount of material from her life. Films, documents, letters, etc., etc., etc. You got access to those. How and what did you find there?
Well, you have to imagine 700 boxes spread to three museums in Berlin, the Museum of Photography, the Cinematographical Museum, the Film Museum in Berlin, second and third, the State Library. And the access was by my producer. She made some sort of deal. Yes, we will digitalize it, so we get an exclusive approach, access to it. But of course, it's just to imagine the photos, 200,000 pictures, photos. Of course, there were doublets, but just to go through, to sift through all these amount of footages, it takes a year or more. So the preparation, I had three archive researchers, one for the photos, the second one for all the written documents in the State Library, and the third one just for the films. There were a lot of private films. Then we had diaries, personal notes, we had the drafts of the memoirs, we had, beside the photos, all the films and some clips which were never used in the film.
So yes, the offcuts.
The offcuts, and so it's something. It's curiosity. I tell you frankly. So because I knew a lot, I knew she is the master of lies and legends, and I thought, of course, I knew from the very beginning, this estate is manipulated. Eleni Riefenstahl, she doesn't just says, okay, before I die, that's my estate, that's fine, leave it like it is.
She'd worked on it.
She worked on it. She prepared it, for sure. But the main question for me from the very beginning was, did she make mistakes? Did she
leave something behind?
Something which could be charged her in the very end. And so, first of all, when we started, I give you an example. There were many, many documents, like, for example, clips, critics of all her work in the 20s, early 20s, home stories from her, from the first films she did in the 1920s. And then there was an interview for 1934, Daily Express, British newspaper. And in her estate, there was just a little hint, 10 lines. There will be interview, look, page 10, something like this. But the interview was missing, so she took it out.
So the front page was there,
yes,
but not the actual interview.
The interview was missing. So we asked for the interview at the archive of the Daily Express. We got it. And what's in? So she was asked, so tell us about what happened. When did you hear about Hitler? And she said...
Just let's remind listeners, this was an interview in 1934.
So, yeah, 1 year after Hitler came to power. And she answered, well, I bought Mein Kampf. This is something like the Bible of Adolf Hitler. Already in 1932. And after reading the first page, I had the book all the time with me during the shooting of The Blue Light. That was her first fiction film. I had the book with me. I was reading it in the breaks, in the morning, at night. And after reading the first page, I became an enthusiastic National Socialist. So that's it. And of course, the interview was missing. So this was, first of all, I was like a detective, yeah? I like a state attorney. So like preparing a tribunal, here's, you're lying in this.
A prosecution case.
Prosecution. And then, step by step, I thought, okay, it's not necessary that I am the prosecutor. She does the job herself, because there are a lot of contradictions, a lot of different storytellings. And the interesting question is not, of course she lied, she was manipulating, but when, at what point a new storytelling came up? She was shifting her...
Well, we'll come to that.
Yeah,
shall
we will
come
to that. But that was when you asked me about the estate, what was the driving force to get into it. So it was curiosity. It was also to find out, in a way, who is Leni Riefenstahl? A very simple question, a close-up of her, because she transferred a public image. When you read your memoirs, it's the same story. There were huge obstacles in my life. Everybody said, you won't make it. And then I got over these obstacles, and in the very end, I was the victorious, I was the greatest. So please, where's the applause? Yeah. And so this is the main structure of everything. So I was looking for contradictions. I was looking for these little cracks.
You found them.
Yeah,
and
I found them. I found a lot of them.
On ABC Radio National Summer, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to the director of a documentary about Leni Riefenstahl. His name, Andres Feil. Now, Andres, she began life as a dancer. She became an actress. How did she find herself a director?
Well, she, as an actress, she was always curious, looking how a director is working, what kind of stage direction does a director give, and how is the camera working. So she was a curious student, in a way, and she was very ambitious. And she knew, in a way, that her abilities as an actress are limited. Yeah, she could just play a hero in the mountains. She was able to climb barefooted. She was able to jump into an abyss of a glacier, things like that. So a very specific part of a sportswoman. And that was something like a challenge, because most of the actresses, they ask for somebody...
A stunt double.
And she said, I do it myself. Of course I do.
Do her own stunts. Yeah, and she was beautiful.
She was beautiful. But she knew other directors, for example, like Sternberg. They were skeptical. So the career was limited. And she said, okay, I have to reinvent myself. What could I do if I don't get other roles, characters with, where she really could show her abilities? But they were limited. And so they thought the only way is to escape. I have to direct my film. I write the part, the role for myself. And that's what she did, in fact. She knew her abilities as a writer were a little bit limited. So she asked a very famous writer, Béla Balázs, to write the script. And the main part, the main role, it was for Leni Riefenstahl. Heroic, well, she was in the mountains, and it's a mythical role, and it was for her a dream. And she realized it, 1932, with the Bible of Adolf Hitler close to her heart.
As she made the film. And revealing one of her talents, which is to get talent, to surround herself with people who could do wonderful work from the start.
Yeah, that's the ability of a director.
Yeah, she's a at which, ladies and gentlemen, Andres points to himself.
no, it's I love
and it. And he does it again.
I have to tell you frankly, because a director is, in a way, he's not really talented, because he encircles, he chooses, selects people who know everything better. And the only ability of a director is to know, okay, this one is even the best, because I'm not very good in it. I'm not good in shooting.
I'm not even going to spend time contradicting this man. Back to Leni Riefenstahl. So this film that she made was a success, a sort of an artistic success. And not long afterwards, Hitler comes to power. Now, a question. Did she approach Hitler, or did Hitler approach her?
She did it. She wrote a letter, and it was shortly after the release of The Blue Light, the film she directed.
The film we were just talking about? Yep.
Yeah, she played the main role, and Hitler answered very, very soon and invited her. And so they met... at the coast, Hitler was preparing a rally for the next election. So he was going from one spot to the other. And only in the memoirs, we have to say, maybe it's a legend. They met at the beach, and she was overwhelmed very soon, even before when they listened to his first speech. She was describing an orgasm, in fact. When you read the memoirs, she listened to his voice, and the earth opened, and a fountain came out of the earth, and she was trembling, shivering.
At the sound of his voice.
Yeah, just the sound of his voice. And so the interesting point is, she reduced the meeting with Hitler to a physical reaction. I was overwhelmed. I couldn't do anything against it. So there was no responsibility, because my body reacted. It were the hormones who reacted. She's describing an orgasm. Mm.
She was helpless in the hands of her own body.
Yeah. It was him. And then at this very moment at the beach, he was asking her, you have to make our films when we come to power. And that's, of course, a legend, because it's written in her memoirs. We don't know if it happened like this, but... So she was overwhelmed. It was a physical reaction. And then it was the offer. And when you see the film, The Blue Light, was somehow critical acclaimed. Mainly the Jewish critics, they wrote harsh reactions she got. on these films. Oh. Yeah. And she said, maybe it's wrong, I don't know, it's another quote. She said, when Hitler comes to power, these Jewish critics, they will write only in Hebrew. Yeah, that's somebody, I don't know if it's true, it's another legend. But you see, it has a reason. It was not just the physical reaction on Fest being mesmerized by the leader, by Hitler, by the Führer. It was also, she knew, okay, she has a problem as an actress. No more good roles because she can't continue climbing on the mountains or playing SOS Iceberg.
That's over.
Yeah, that's over. And maybe also the career as a director is over. She has to reach a new horizon. And the new horizon is Adolf Hitler. And the promise, you're going to make our films. And she said, of course she said yes. What an offer. The Führer offers me to make the film for the Reich.
In later life, she would call this being commissioned,
yes,
as though it was a completely sort of a financial arrangement for which she had no personal commitment. So she's being commissioned. And the result of the commission is the triumph of the will. Now, what are the innovations that she brought to making that film that stood her apart at that time and perhaps ever since? For that kind of spectacle, that kind of purpose.
Yeah, well, when you see, when you look at the cinematographic language of the film, she invented or used a kind of technical tools like, for example, an elevator. So with the elevator, the camera was on an elevator, and you could move from down to a higher position.
And
to
this
show.
Is her. This is her.
That's, no, it's a mix. It's her, as I said, she chose DOPs, cameramen, who were able, who were innovative. She selected them. Why? She said, okay, this guy is not so much experienced, but he was the ski jumper being in the air. So the camera was in a subjective position. He just bent the camera on his leg.
Yes.
Yeah. And she said, okay, this is my man. He is not so experienced, but he tries something which never somebody else tried before. So that was the way she said, okay, I need these people who are innovative, who try something. So let's think about how can we show the choreography of the masses from above? How can we show the strength of the Führer? Low angle shot. So the camera, if the Führer is above, we have to put the camera here and we have to move the camera. So there were no rails in this time, so they had to put them on roller skates. So they said to the cameraman, use your roller skates. So, and then they had a lot of movements coming closer. They had not a zoom objective in these years, so they had to use roller skates. They had later to use a balloon. They had no drones. They had to use a balloon, and et cetera, et cetera. So they invented underwater cameras for the high diving scenes in Olympia. They invented underwater cameras.
Those were hers. Her
she
invention.
Did it, or she engaged the DOPs, the cameramen, who were able to be innovative, and that's a skill. Of course, it's a skill. It's a talent.
She had an eye for beautiful men.
Yeah, yeah. And she used it in a way. It's interesting. So when you think about her lovers, first of all, maybe you can say it's two class of lovers. One where she was totally dominant. But on the other hand, she had lovers, and maybe it's the other side of the coin, who mistreated her with violence. They raped her. They were very brutal, like her. The first meeting of a brutal man was her father. And so it was an experience of violence in her life. And so in the end, she had a lover who was 40 years younger, yeah, and Horst Kettner. And he was more like a boy for her, a student, a kid, a servant,
and
a technical
enough.
Support. So it's interesting how a mixture of using men And at the same time, she was the victim sometimes in some relationships, in very brutal relationships. And for me, it was necessary to, when I call the term close-up, it means to understand her, why she choose relationships in a very ambivalent way. She sucked these men in a way, took their energy, used them for all her necessities and needs. And on the other hand, there was a way of being the small kid, and she was beaten up, and it was very destructive. It was a toxic relationship to a lot of men. The first lover raped her. Goebbels, if it's true, raped her. Her first husband, what she describes in the diaries, it was a very brutal relationship. He beats her up and pulled her, and was able really to be... It was a horror love story, when we believe what she wrote in letters and in the diary. Of course, she wanted to make her films, and Goebbels was the minister of propaganda, so he was the one who said, okay, you get the money. Buff was only Adolf Hitler. So to reject Goebbels was a risky game, because she needed the support of Goebbels and his ministry. And so the only way to make a detour around Goebbels was to go directly to Hitler. And she did it. When Goebbels blocked her for whatever reasons, and I have doubts, because I read letters to Goebbels. And when you think about the memoirs, she always said that it was a horror relationship, and he wanted to stop me whenever he could. I had to go to Hitler to complain about Goebbels. But I found letters very friendly. I'm preparing Olympia right now, and I'm so grateful. And I thought, this is the guy who raped her. So is it a strategic way of dealing with a man who raped her? Or did it happen? So you have a lot of, it's a black box.
So Olympia, this is the film she made of the Berlin Olympics, for which she had an enormous budget and a huge crew. Was this unprecedented in its lavishness?
It was totally unprecedented. She achieved to get as much as she wanted. She said, okay, I have 30 different places, so I need 30 plus cameramen. And she decided, she got the rushes in the evening from the day. She watched the rushes, and then she said, okay, this guy is excellent. He will take over this scene with this perspective. This guy is medium. This is not such an important place. Let's put him here. She met at 11 p.m. or at midnight. She met the whole crew, and then she gave orders. Okay, you go here, you go there, you make this, you make that. And she was the boss. We got pictures from, she was sitting around 30-something cameraman, and she was sitting on a table or something, and pointing at this and that, and gave instructions. And of course, it's when you think of the situation, 1936, party hierarchy, there were only men. And in the film industry, DOPs, there were no women at all. And she was the only one. And she achieved everything. Why? Again, she used the tools of an actress. So when Goebbels told her, sorry, but the Olympic Committee said, you are not allowed to dig a hole to go, if the people, runners or whatever, to film them from the low angle position, you're not allowed, it's dangerous to dig a hole. Yes. She shouted, she cried, and she said, I go to the Führer. And what happened? She could dig the hole. Of course she could. And that's a way of using the pressure tools, of course.
And the result, the film, is a film that's still celebrated today for its cinematography, for what she managed to achieve there. I mean, it remains a celebrated film, does it not?
Yeah, but you have to see two aspects are important. You're right. When I see the high diving scenes, it's still breathtaking. It's amazing how she keeps these bodies somehow in the air like birds. They're turning upside down. But there's, I call it, it's the storytelling. When you look, and I counted Hitler, how often Hitler shows up in the film, mainly in the first part.
Yes.
It's 28 times.
Really? 28 times?
So, and all the main scenes start from the perspective. Are you showing Adolf Hitler how he's following? And of course, she used mostly when the German team won and got the Olympic medal or something, at least silver. And you show Hitler how he's looking and smiling and following. And so it's an homage to the Führer. One thing.
We don't see Hitler's response when that black American athlete
wins.
No,
of course
oddly
not.
Enough, yeah. Not, no yeah. room at that
she was
point.
In, later on, she was very proud that she just used the US-American black Jesse Owens in the film. But anyway, but the second aspect, which I think is very important, I call it the night inside, when it's the dark part of Olympia. And in the film, in our film, we showed the dark part is the ideology behind, and it's not only celebrating the victorious, but celebrating the strongness. No, it's a contempt of the weakness. It's a contempt of frailing people, of sick people, of the foreigners. Why? There was a cameraman, Willy Zieke. He filmed the prologue. And after...
That was set in Greece.
In Greece, yeah. And after he finished, there was a lot of effort. It was really a challenge. After he finished, he had a breakdown, a psychotic breakdown. He, between schizophrenia and psychosis. Anyway, he was admitted to a psychiatry and he was forcibly sterilized after 6 months. And Leni Riefenstahl didn't intervene at all. She was just committed to the editing process, of course. And she knew, she learned about the situation of Willy Zieke, and she admired him for his talents. He was an excellent DOP, but she was not interested in his fate at all. So he was forcibly sterilized. And it has something to do, I come back to the Bible of Adolf Hitler. And in the film, we quote Adolf Hitler from Mein Kampf. And what is written there, it's very simple. Health of the German people is above everything. And if somebody becomes a hereditary disease, he has to be sterilized. That's we have to rescue, to clean up the German race. Have to hold dear the purity of the German race.
Purity, that word, purity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why, I call it the night side of the aesthetics. And that's why we come back to the beginning, we can't separate, in case of Leni Riefenstahl, aesthetics and politics. It's one and the same issue.
On ABC Radio National Summer, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to the director of a documentary about Leni Riefenstahl. His name, Andres Feil. Now, Olympia came out in 1938. The war broke out shortly after that. What was her role in the early years of the war? What did she do?
She was a war correspondent. In the very first days of the war, she went to Poland. The war The German war started in Poland in 1939 in September. And her task was to follow Adolf Hitler, to make a heroic portrait of the Führer. And for specific reasons, she arrived too late. Hitler was gone, and she said, okay, what we could film is the German army, heroic, strong, courageous. And for some reason, four soldiers were killed, and she wanted to film the burial of these soldiers. And Jews were just forced to dig the grave, a hole in the middle of the village for these four soldiers. And suddenly she started to give stage directions to say, okay, the dirty Jews out of the frame, Jews off. And for some reason, the Jews panicked, and she became a catalyst of the first massacre, because the Jews wanted to run away. They were shot, first one, then 10, then 20, 22 in the very end, were killed, were murdered by German soldiers. And she was not only an eyewitness, she was maybe even a catalyst. It's a letter I found in her estate. She didn't remove it for
that
some reason.
That one she kept.
She kept it. And so, in fact, she was, when you look at her stories, how she was dealing with the different aspects of the massacre, in the beginning, till 1952, we have notes, she didn't question her eyewitness, her role being an eyewitness at this very cruel atrocity of massacre.
She admitted it.
She admitted it. But after 1952, she changes the narrative. She says, no, I was far away. I didn't, well, I heard some shootings, but I never was close to all what happened.
Did any of this film that she took in the war, did it ever emerge? Did anything ever come of it? What did she do for the rest of the war?
I tell you, it's first of all, she, after being an eyewitness or even a catalyst, she said, I want to finish this job. She continued a little bit, but she asked Hitler to stop it. And her team continued filming, and parts of it are in the... There was something like it's so-called Wochenschau. It's a weekly cinema news program. But there was never a film of Leni Riefenstahl for the big screen published regarding the events in Poland or afterwards.
Yeah, just what we would call newsreels.
Newsreels, yeah. Yes. And so the interesting point, she said to Hitler, I offer you something else. I'm sorry I couldn't make the portrait of the greatest leader ever, Adolf Hitler, but I offer you a work. You love the opera Tiefland, Lowlands. I will make a fiction film, and it's a present for you instead of giving you the portrait.
Of this opera that he loved.
Yeah, yeah, his favorite opera. So, and that's what he did, what she did the following 4 years. She was working it. It was, in the end, it was finished in 1954, a long time after the war. It was a disaster. Nobody wanted to see it then. So it was, in a way, the end of the career. But it was one of the most expensive fiction films in the Third Reich. Again, because you get all the money from Adolf Hitler. All the money he earned from selling Mein Kampf, she got for the realization of the opera film Lowlands. It's absurd. But the important point was, for me...
Are the extras.
Are the extras, yes, that she wanted to shoot in Spain. And for some reason, it was not possible because of the war. So she had to have extras, because the story plays in Spain. She had to have extras with this specific southern I don't know, but somehow they shouldn't look German.
They had to look right, yes.
Yeah. So, and she asked for gypsies, Roma and Sinti.
Who were being rounded up along with Jews and homosexuals.
Yeah, they were in internment camps already. And she worked with them. And it's a very ambivalent story because, in a way, for them, it was somehow a relief to get out of the camps and to work as extras because the food was better. But the critical issue, after the shooting finished, they had to get back in the internment camps, and 50% of the extras were sent to Auschwitz and were killed, were murdered. And she knew it. And she, of course, she was informed about the camps like Auschwitz, that they are not there, just people could work there and have a living. No, they could work for a couple of months and then they were just murdered in the gas chambers. And she knew it. And so it's ambivalent because I learned it some weeks ago, for some of the extras, she tried to help them. And so they weren't taken to Auschwitz, 20 extras, but the rest was killed. And it's she was a master of death and life in a way. And the problem for her after the war, she couldn't say, I rescued them. I didn't want them to get murdered in a gas in Auschwitz. Because then
would have to admit.
Yes, that she knew before, during the war, that she knew about Auschwitz. So she was in her own trap, yeah? Because for her, the legend was always I learned about the atrocities after the war. But first of all, she was eyewitness, maybe even the catalyst of the first massacre in Poland, in Konskie, in September 1939. So she knew from the very beginning, and maybe even she was an anti-Semit when she said, Jews out of the image, the story I mentioned before, she wanted to film the burial of the German soldiers. The Jews had to dig the funeral hole and for the coffins. And she said, Jews are disturbing, they are dirty, out of the image. Of course it's anti-Semitic, because the Jews are dirty and they are disturbing the courageous image of the German soldiers. And that's being a catalyst, first of all, being much more responsible for being a catalyst, then you are, of course, responsible what happened afterwards. Even she didn't intend the massacre, but she was, as a catalyst, she was responsible.
And she saw it.
She saw it.
But she always admitted as well that her Jewish friends, this is in the 1930s, that her Jewish friends were leaving Germany. Even, she says at one point in the documentary, the last of them to go was my doctor.
Yeah.
And yet she was claiming to be unaware of why they were leaving Germany.
Yeah, and how they were treated. Yeah, before she was even, and that's in the film. So somebody interviews her and asking her, showing her how asylum seekers were treated in the post-GDR time, German Democratic Republic time, in the 90s. They were set fire at asylum homes. Yeah. And they were burned down, yeah, in Germany in the 90s. And she said, no, that never happened in the Third Reich. And of course, there was the so-called Reichskristallnacht in 1938, in November. Hundreds of synagogues were burned down.
All were
deported and killed. There were more than 100 Jews were killed in 1938, 1 year before the war started. And she was ignoring it. She just, more than that, she was not ignoring it. She was lying and saying, no, never happened anything. My doctor just had to leave, like he's taking a ship or a plane to leave the country.
He was asthmatic. He needed a better climate.
Yeah.
Anders, let's leap forward, because after the war, the authorities kind of cleared her. Essentially, the film Lowlands got her nowhere. How did she then live? I suspect that she lived in the 50s and 60s by selling interviews.
Yeah, that's one part. And she was very successfully. She was really a businesswoman. So, for example, there was a Canadian broadcasting company. They asked for an interview, and she asked for money. It was, in the end, a half-hour interview, and she got 10,000 Deutschmark. When you compare it to today, it's 10,000 Deutschmark. It's something like, it was 1965, it's something like, I would say, 150,000 Australian dollars today. Yeah, for yeah. one interview, it takes half a day, not more.
Because and she was a celebrity.
She was a celebrity, first thing. And secondly, when you ask how did she survive, she was very clever by selling, for example, Olympia. She taped phone calls, so we have the negotiations. She taped the negotiations.
She even taped those.
She taped everything, but then you can listen. So somebody asking for, we want to broadcast Olympia, two parts, something like 200 minutes. And Horst Kettner, her husband, later her husband, was negotiating. He said 3,000 Deutschmark a minute, meaning something like $5,000, $10,000 a minute. Then you just have to calculate. For me, what was really irritating when you see how many victims of the Third Reich, when you think of inmates of concentration camps, forced laborers, they had to fight decades to get a very, very low compensation. And these perpetrators, like Leni Riefenstahl, they got just for an interview because they were celebrities of the Third Reich. They get huge amount of money and for selling Olympia. And she, we have to say it frankly, she was not the owner of the rights because the films were financed by the state. So the state was the owner, but she pretended it's my film.
And she got away with it.
Yeah, she got away with it. Even the High Court of Germany said, no, it's not your film. But the agency of the state collaborated with her and they didn't change the contract. So it's really painful when you see how Germany dealt with the past. In the 60s, in the 70s, there was a continuity of collaboration of these old guys from the Nazi party, and they offered her a great life.
You also say in the documentary that she fought something like 50 defamation cases. Did she win them?
No.
No. So
Some of them.
But by fighting 50 defamation cases, it must have meant, at least in Germany, that you had to take care commenting about this woman in her lifetime.
Yeah, she was dangerous. And of course, some people used the shadow of the Third Reich. For example, Louis Drenker, he was a colleague, an actor. And after the war, he wrote the diaries. He faked the diaries of the lover of Adolf Hitler, Eva. And in these so-called diaries, he described Leni Riefenstahl dancing naked in front of Hitler. And of course, it was a scandal and people love to read stuff like that. But it was...
And she sued.
Yeah, and successfully.
Of course.
Yeah, but there are many, many other cases. For example... She said, even 1 year, 2 years before she died, she said, I met all my extras from Tiefland, from Lowlands, the Sinti and Roma extras, alive, all of them. I met them after the war alive and happily. And of course, it was wrong because 50% were killed in Auschwitz.
As you said. But we've only a few minutes left. And one of the things I thought we should make clear is that when she was being interviewed, selling these interviews, sometimes hostile and very professional questioning, she was overwhelmed with support from people who heard or watched these interviews. Yes, yes, you were absolutely right. These people are beasts to make these accusations against you.
That's a typical German reaction of the 70s, because I would say the majority of German people were fed up of the so-called Aufarbeitung, dealing with the past. And they said, now we have to be proud of Germany again. We, in fact, going a step further and saying it will take one or two generations and Germany will come back to the values of decency, of virtue. And she says, yes, the German people are predestined of all these values. It will take one or two generations, and that's the present. Yeah. And in fact, the film is a warning out of the future, because everything what we touch, the rise of the far right, the renaissance of the aesthetics of heroism, the use of fake news, it's a topicality. Of course it's a topicality. And so it's not only a film on Leni Riefenstahl, it's a film on how people have a need, a necessity for lies, for legends. It's not this or that leader, it's the majority of people. And that's something which is threatening for me, and that's why I had to make this film.
And do you think that Leni Riefenstahl would be celebrating the rise of a party like the Alternative for Deutschland?
Yeah, of course, because she was stuck in the ideology. For sure, she would celebrate, and they would celebrate her. And they do, in fact, because I tell you frankly, I got death threats. After the film was released in Germany, I got death threats by those people who say, you spit on a monument like Leni Riefenstahl. And when we will come to power, you will just, some bones of you will be the rest of you. Yeah, so
all that will be left are your bones.
Yeah, and not even a dog will lick on your bones, because even the dogs will vomit when they see your bones. So that's very nice. You see, and these people are shameless now.
And how powerful is that party now?
It's really threatening in a way, because now it's the strongest party. When you see the current polls, it gets more than the Conservative Party, more than the Social Democratic Party. They are leading now.
What do you think Leni Riefenstahl's life has to say about the situation in Germany now, where pro-Palestinian voices are very difficult to be heard?
Well, for my point, I always say human rights are universal, and you cannot divide them and say, okay, these group of people, they are privileged towards human rights in this part because of the German past. We have to oversee and put it a little bit aside what happens in Gaza. And it's something I try to fight in Germany, because I feel very bad, because I have been often in Israel and also have a very close relationships to Palestinians. And to balance it out is so important, and not to be blind on one eye. But it's a challenge, especially in Germany with the past, because of course we are biased. And I am biased in a way too, because my grandfather was a general in war, and my grandfather prepared the battlefield for the SS to kill millions of Jews. And so there's a personal responsibility, but on the same time, I always say human rights are universal. We can't divide them and say, okay, these are a little bit, these people are more privileged, like the Palestinians, because we have the German past. So it's really a tightrope walk for me personally.
Andres, thank you. I've been talking to Andres Feil about his documentary Riefenstahl. Thank you very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Yeah, thank you also very much for the interesting questions.
That's it for another week of Late Night Live Summer. My thanks as always to the team, Catherine Zengerer, Ali Benton, Alex Tai, and executive producer Jack Schmidt.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.